Welcome to the Open Up Europe podcast, the show dedicated to your journey of success in Europe. Every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Central European Time, a warm and fresh episode with an incredible entrepreneur, investor, or a thought leader will be available for your earbuds. Here is your host from Brussels, Cedar Oak.
Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of Open Up Europe podcast. And as usual, this is your host, Cedar speaking. I'm stoked to bring you an extraordinary guest today. He was recently named as one of the top 100 influencers of European tech scene by Wired magazine. He has written in top outlets like TechCrunch and The Next Web. He's a speaker in many conferences all over Europe. And if that's not enough, he is the founder of Tech.eu, a European tech media outlet. He is Robin Wouters, and we had an extraordinary interview with him. Listen to the interview till the end and you will hear Robin answering questions like how can one become a top journalist in Europe like he is, and what are the must-dos for an entrepreneur to receive a solid PR. I really enjoyed every minute of it, and without further ado, I leave you to Robin Wouters. Hi Robin, thanks a million for accepting to be on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You have been recently named as number 34 in the top 100 European tech influencers by Wired. First of all, congratulations on that. And how does it feel like?
Thank you very much. I think it was actually number 65. What does it feel like? It doesn't really do anything except for, you know, it's just a recognition of the work that I've been doing. And we're working quite hard. So I'm always happy when that gets recognized. And it's not like you get a special title or cash or an island or a car for it. But in general, I'm just happy that
the work... No island?
No island yet. Maybe next year.
They could at least do that, right?
That's a minimum.
Yeah. And apart from being a successful journalist that we all know, what's your own perspective about the road that led to this?
So it's funny, but because people see me as what I am today is a European journalist, obviously writing about technology. But I was never really trained as a journalist. I actually studied marketing, so corporate communications was actually the name of the degree that I got. I did marketing for tech companies in the very beginning of my career, and I sort of got rolled into blogging just as a hobby. Writing more about online advertising and marketing in the beginning, and then sort of with the whole, do you remember the Web 2.0 startup movement, mm-hmm. 2005, 2006? Okay. I kind of got interested in the whole startup movement and just kind of rolled into it. And I'm a journalist now, but I was never actually formally trained as one.
So by background, you consider yourself more of an entrepreneur than a journalist?
Well, not so much an entrepreneur as just a fan of technology and communication. Blogging is just a side effect of my passion for technology, I guess you could call it.
I see. So the road that led to all this has not come from what you have studied, basically, but out of your passion.
Exactly. So I've always enjoyed reading and writing, and technology has always been a key element in my life, just general being on the internet, just wasting time on computers, has been a big part of my youth. And this kind of, this reflects in what I do today.
Mm-hmm. And in this area of lots of information, like the information overload, like being a journalist would be like twice as hard as being a normal person in this ecosystem. How do you keep up with that?
Just by not sleeping very much, I guess. But it's true what you say. I mean, there is an information overload, but I mean, you could say the same about the situation 10 years ago. There were already people complaining about it, mm-hmm. then. So that's still true today. I always tell people, like, a journalist doesn't necessarily write as much as they read. So we do a lot of reading. We track a lot of sources. We try to keep up with other publications and other writers. So it's tough. I mean, you develop a process. You use the tools that you feel comfortable with, and then you just, as I said, you spend a lot of hours doing it.
I see. And do you have an organized approach to that, or is it more developed over the experience of the years?
You know, not really. I used to have like an RSS feed reader and just general like an email filtering system.
Who didn't?
Who didn't, right? But a lot of people still do, but I just use Twitter. Basically, I use some Twitter lists. Some key people that I follow, I try to keep track of of a few influencers or a few publications that I know aggregate a lot of information from other sources that I do not have to follow for that reason. TechMeme is one example for mostly US tech news. And then there's just a few curated lists on Twitter, either made by myself or made by others that are make it easier to follow.
All right. So since we have gotten into the tech news space now,
sure.
So you have started the tech.eu, and it's relatively a new platform, but it's trending quite heavily and it's very successful. What does tech.eu have the other outlets don't?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So just for background, I used to work for a few years at TechCrunch and The Next Web as a European editor, where I focused mostly on a lot of news. But when you look at what's going on in Europe, not just in the major hubs, London, Berlin, etc., but in all of Europe, which for me includes also countries like Russia, Israel, Turkey, the Balkans, which are not necessarily European Union, but Europe for me, you see all these interesting things happening in technology, innovation, in startups, in investments. And I really thought, I really felt that nobody was really capturing all of it in an efficient way. Not my employers and not my ex-employers at the time. So I thought there was just room for a publication that kind of went in depth and trying to connect the dots, trying to take like a helicopter view and give a big picture of what goes on here. So that's what we're trying to do with TechEU. I've been around for about a year and a half now.
Yeah, and it turns out that there was. So
yeah, I mean, we don't focus on news, which kind of limits the audience that you can touch. So it's a little bit of a hard route that we took. I think it might have been easier to just focus on news and try to keep, you know, break news and be first and just, you know, interview the celebrities rather than the largely unknown entrepreneurs from other corners of Europe. But that would have been the easy thing. So we tried to do the difficult thing, which is, you know, build a niche audience very slowly, one step at a time.
I see. I started to open up Europe also on the frustration of not having enough resources for European entrepreneurs. Whenever you look at every bit of advice or resource or information, doesn't necessarily like the up-to-date type of information, but like the advice really, is crafted for the Valley. They talk, not even the rest of USL, really like the Valley. So
that's absolutely true. And it's also, people keep saying like we don't have enough role models in Europe. But the fact of the matter is we do have a lot of role models, but a Spanish entrepreneur will not necessarily know or read about someone who's made it in Slovakia or in the Nordics or in Russia because they don't really care or relate to that person. If nobody brings it to their attention, then they might not think it's relevant for them. So we try to kind of overcome that barrier.
Yeah, and with a lot of reasons, we cannot also relate very easily to the role models that the US culture pushes upon us, right?
That's very true. The US tends to have a little bit of a celebrity culture in general. You see that in media, you see that in movies, in music, and that translates very easily to entrepreneurship where they are. But they also have a much bigger audience, you know 300 million people in the US that speak the same language. So it's easier to become quote unquote the celebrity in entrepreneurship in the US than it is in Europe.
Yeah, indeed. And how do you think that we will have a breakthrough against this in Europe?
I think just by banging the drum, just by giving attention to the people that are really making a difference. Not necessarily by being the noisiest, but by really building impactful, sustainable companies and projects and initiatives and organizations. Just by highlighting them as much as we possibly can in conferences, in media, in conversations that we have with European policymakers, big corporations that are trying to get in touch with the startup ecosystem, just kind of surfacing them, I guess.
I see. And I also feel that we are lacking a little bit of the glamour here about the entrepreneurship in Europe, right? Not as much as it is in US. It could be also partially the cultural difference that you were just the celebrity culture you were just talking about.
I don't know about that. I mean, glamour in general, I don't think there's a lot of glamour in tech entrepreneurship. I think a lot of the successful people that we tend to look at as living a life of glamour have also been working very hard and, you know, failing a lot and getting up again and restarting and overcoming challenges just like any other entrepreneur. I'd much rather focus on that part of the journey than the end result.
I see. And what about your own journey? So you obviously, when I look at your career, you obviously had lots of years of experience in like top media outlets like TechCrunch and the Next Web, etc. So you had a nice going, and I think that a steady paycheck, etc. So what pushed you through the edge and made you set up your own thing?
It's a good question. So first of all, I think I already answered the question with the general mission that we have for TechU.
But more personal, like, what was your inner motivation to say that, I can do better?
It's not necessarily better, it's different. I guess for me personally, it was also a fact that I was actually let go from the Next Web, so I didn't move voluntarily. They let me go in July 2013, and back then I was already toying with the idea of starting something of my own. I've always really enjoyed starting new stuff. I used to run a conference in Brussels that I started from scratch. Mm-hmm. And I was also an entrepreneur involved with some early stage startups in Belgium here. So I really like starting my own stuff, and that being let go from the Next Web actually gave me the opportunity and the time to go for it. So I just kind of went for it.
So you were pushed through the edge by the Next Web?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, it would have happened eventually, I'd like to think. Mm-hmm. But it kind of accelerated things, I guess.
That's great. You know, you never know what will help shape your destiny that you want in the first hand, right?
Exactly. And I'm very grateful to the publications that I've been able to work with. I've learned a lot. I've met a lot of people through it. So I'm very grateful of the opportunities that I've been given. So
mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you were a young aspiring tech journalist today, starting from scratch, what do you think the path that he or she should follow to be a successful journalist?
That's a very good question. I've never really thought about it. I guess I would say if you want to be a tech journalist, then you should write about tech. And when I say write about tech, it means writing about technology every single day, and not necessarily focusing on the big ones like the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons, but really exploring the innovation that goes on in the fringes in other countries, maybe Asia or Europe, in other areas like drones or artificial intelligence. I would focus on the stuff that's coming rather than the stuff we see today. And I would write pretty much every day. If you get a chance as a young journalist to work for a big publication, rather than starting your own blog, I would totally go for it, because I really think you can pick up a lot of knowledge and a lot of experience just by working with very experienced and seasoned journalists, and then seeing how a newsroom works and seeing how an editorial process goes, what an editor actually does. So all of that stuff, if you have a chance to get that experience firsthand, then I should totally go for it. But you know, in the end, I think there's a lot of opportunities for freelance journalists to do their own thing. You know, you have all the tools available to you. You have a self-publishing software, you have audience distribution. So everything's already there. If you can find a unique voice and you're really a good journalist, then it will surface eventually. So I think there's a lot of room for talent to kind of surface from bottom up.
I see. So your main advice is to practice, really, to become a good journalist and being able to find the voice.
Yeah, so, I mean it goes for every job or profession. You have to practice and you have to do it a lot to get good at it. Mm-hmm. But for writing specifically, if you want to be a blogger, then you should blog pretty much every day. You cannot do it half-heartedly, if you know what I mean. You can't just sit down and say, you know, now I'm going to be a blogger. This is really something you have to be passionate about. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to sustain yourself. It's also a very, very challenging, stressful job sometimes. So if you're not passionate about it, you won't last long.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, really very surprised how you can keep up with all these, and because you love your family and you seem to have some time for them too. So where does this extra time come from? It cannot be all from sleep deprivation.
Well, listen, this is the same for every entrepreneur, I guess. If you're running a company, you're always going to have to make sacrifices and choices. And for me, it's no different. I mean, I wish I could see my family 24 hours a day. But that's just not possible. It's also not possible for everyone working a 9-to-5 job. So I guess you make choices. I work from home, so I see them a lot when I'm actually here, when I'm not traveling. So that compensates. I'm not stuck in traffic jams every morning and every afternoon. So that kind of compensates. I guess it's just a matter of finding a balance. I'm also based in Brussels, which is not necessarily a very, you know, dynamic startup hub. There's some stuff happening here, but it's not as intense as it would be. It's not as intense as it would be in Brussels or in London or Berlin. So I'm very grateful for not living in one of these places, because it'd be much more difficult, actually.
So you would have to attend lots of more events or...
Well, you would get constantly invited, and there would be a constant temptation to go to all these events and meet people and, you know, go out to do interviews. But for me, I actually have to make a conscious decision. Do I want to travel there? For an event or for an interview or a meeting. So that makes it a little bit easier.
But you still travel quite a lot, I mean.
Yeah, too much. I mean, listen, if you're an early stage investor in Europe, and you want to be a pan-European investor, then there's going to be travel. If you want to be a European tech journalist and you want to cover startup innovation in Europe, you're going to have to travel. There is no way out of that. I mean, in the US, you can pretty much stay in the Valley and cover tech from a Valley perspective, and you would never have to travel. In Europe, that's just not possible. You have to go to places and meet people on the ground and see for the office spaces and the culture and meet the actual entrepreneurs at their local scenes, because that's where you get the best idea of what's going on.
Are you enjoying European Startup Conversations? Do you want to see it continue? Your feedback is the best way to do it. Head over to iTunes and leave us a review. That means a lot.
Since you are traveling a lot, you have to, and you are also seeing lots of developments and verticals that is tied to a specific country or specific city. What are the most promising ones do you see nowadays in the investable startup scene of Europe?
I guess fintech would be the obvious answer. Financial technology and services are very, very strong in general in Europe, not just in London, but also in Berlin, Paris, and places like Barcelona even. So that's really an area that European companies tend to excel in, and that I think we're going to see a lot more investments.
Why do you think that is? What do you attribute this to?
I don't know. I think a part of it is with a large frustration, both from entrepreneurs and just generally young people with traditional banks and insurance companies. And it's also an area that's, you know, if you come from the banking industry, which is a huge industry in the UK, for example, it's not always going very well in that area. So there's a large incentive for people from that industry to try and do their own thing. And the most obvious thing to do for them is, because if they built up this knowledge and experience already, is to go into fintech, right? Yeah. And you can say the same about, for example, gaming in Finland, where a lot of the big gaming companies were actually, you know, in the years before Rovio and Supercell and whatnot, just in the years before that, there were already big gaming companies. I see a lot of the creatives and the designers and the game developers coming from those companies and kickstarting their own. So I guess it's a cycle.
I see. And do you think that the city matters?
The city that you are in Europe does matter. I mean, I would be lying if I would say that that's not the case. If you have a startup in Sofia, in Bulgaria, you might make it. But the reality is your chances of getting investments, of getting partnerships, of getting advertising deals are much higher when you go to other places, London, Berlin, or Paris. And that's just the case. I mean, you can build very, very successful companies everywhere or anywhere, and everyone knows that. I think that's not a secret anymore. But the reality is, for some sectors and for some entrepreneurs and for some verticals, it just might be easier to move to a major hub.
Yeah, I see. So if let's say that you were a startup founder with a great idea in one of those verticals, what would your next steps be rather than moving to that city?
So first of all, there has to be a very conscious decision if you want to move, because it also means you have to move your life there if you have a family or whatever, your friends. So that's a conscious decision that you have to make on a personal level. Second, I would get in touch with the people on the ground that really make things happen, the entrepreneurs, the connectors, the guys who organize the meetups and you know, the early stage investors that are very keen on meeting new people and just sort of, you know, build a network of people, because otherwise it wouldn't make any sense to move anywhere if you're not going to build a network, right? So
talking about that network, so for sure you are getting tons of pitches on a daily basis to be featured on the publications and to hone on your network. So what makes a promising one to stand out from them?
That's a good question. So I get pitched a lot less than I used to, simply because we don't really focus on news anymore. But I tend to, whenever I go to startup conferences and I'm asked to do like a workshop or whatever, I typically do it around how to do PR as a startup founder. Mm-hmm. And one of the tips I always give is, you know, build something amazing first. So this is where it all, for me, it all begins and ends with. If you build something amazing, then people are going to take notice. And preferably it will be paying customers that are taking notice. Press would be second, right? So you first have to build something, like you have to build a product or a business or both, preferably, and then start reaching out to press, not necessarily the other way around.
As entrepreneurs, we are very, very optimistic, right? We build something and we think that it is really the best. And at a time of those highs, not the downs, but those highs, we could think that it's really good, but we just need a little bit of press. So how do we get that point?
It's a good question that I don't have an answer to. The reality is the press or the publicity that you get is not going to make your product any better. That's it true. Might give you a short-term boost in users or revenue, but if that's your end goal, then you're going to be very disappointed. So press should be a side effect. Press should come because you've already built something solid and not the other way around. So I think just people tend to make the mistakes that you know, if you talk to journalists and they will give you some attention, then good things are going to happen. Good things typically happen when you work hard and when you're very passionate about something. And press usually follows that. I get a lot of pitches. I get a lot of bad pitches. The good ones just give me everything I need. They tell me what you do, which problem you're solving, for which market, who your competitors are, how you're different. You know, so if you bundle all that information into one message, then you already have a step up, because a lot of people don't, right? And you also have to be able to give a journalist an angle. You have to, you know, did you raise funding? Yeah, but who from and why? What are you going to do with that money? And who are your investors? That kind of stuff really matters. You have a new partnership? Okay, why? Which company? And what's this partnership going to bring you? So all of these press releases that I tend to see are mostly focused around product or announcements that are very poorly explained or don't really attempt to convince a journalist to find an angle for it.
Yeah, and I don't remember the last time that I've read a press release really as a reader of tech news. I mean, at the end of the day, the tech journalists are crafting news for me to read, right? So if audience doesn't like it, they will stop doing that, and they are stopping doing that.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Press releases tend to look all the same in the end. So I guess also as a startup founder, you have to ask yourself the question, do we still need to send press releases, or should we just be, you know, doing our own corporate blog or reaching out on Twitter or Facebook or personally with a hangout with journalists at events, et cetera. So,
yeah, indeed. So, so about the we have talked about the verticals that are promising and the tech hubs that are tied to them. Apart from those verticals, what are the European, which European tech hubs do you see as the most promising, apart from the known ones, right? Like London, Berlin, Paris. But what do you think the next wave of hubs is going to look like?
So that's a tricky question, because I tend to look at the European startup ecosystem as a whole. So, you know, obviously there's different parts to it. There's London, Berlin, Paris, as you mentioned. There's also Helsinki, there's Stockholm, there's Barcelona. There's, if you look further, you know, there's some really big companies being built in Russia out of Moscow. There are some big companies being built in Turkey out of Istanbul. Eastern Europe in general, there tends to be you know, there's some really great companies coming out of that, not necessarily in one hub, but just in general. So I guess just following each region and taking into account their maturity and their challenges and opportunities as a country or as a region really helps you form a better image. So it's very hard to answer that question. I think what's happening in Eastern Europe, for example, is very, very interesting, not necessarily because it's mature and there's going to, like, you know, lots of unicorns are going to come out of there, or lots of acquisitions. That doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is there a foundation? Is there a basis being built for great startups to, you know, to be enabled to become scale-ups and eventually unicorns and maybe exits? What I care about most is there a foundation? Are there enough, you know, accelerators, angel investors? Is the government, you know, implementing policies that are helpful for entrepreneurs? Are there people that are actually helping out other entrepreneurs to become more successful? That sort of thing is much more important to me see in Europe.
Yeah, one home run doesn't make up a team, right?
So exactly. And it's also a cycle. I mean, if you get successful companies, then usually those employees of those companies will end up starting their own. Or if you have an exit, then that money will tend to flow back into the ecosystem. But you have to start somewhere, right? So it doesn't really happen overnight. So I guess in some countries it's just exciting to see the foundations happening, and in some countries or regions it's just exciting to see the results already coming in.
Yeah, got it. So actually, when I search for the next Silicon Valley in Google, it brings me 68 million results. So therefore, we will pass on this cliche. But
No. Let's not pass on that cliche. It's funny that you mentioned that, because there are these regions and countries that, or cities that tend to call themselves the next Silicon Valley for whatever reasons. But it's never the smart people. It's always some idiot or a government spokesperson or whatever that says it. So you have to take into account that really smart entrepreneurs and really smart people don't tend to make that for good reason. Silicon Valley is very, very, very unique in every sense of the way. The way that it was formed, the history, the vicinity of, you know, top universities with lots of entrepreneurs and a high density of people that are good at development and design, etc. It's just very, very...
And California, unique. Right?
Yeah, and California. So you can't copy it. So why would you try? Why would you even try to, you know, build something like that? You have to take the opportunities that you have, and you have to take into account the assets that you have and try to make the best out of your region and your city, but you're never going to be able to copy Silicon Valley. And you don't have to. That's the point.
Yeah, and that seems to me also the celebrity culture that you were talking about. Like, Silicon Valley is the celebrity of the tech hubs, and it is seen as something juicy and catchy to make some news on that and saying, next Silicon Valley is going to be Tel Aviv. It's going to be no Brussels.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, in Silicon Valley, there are people that work very hard and that are very smart. And you know, you have a lot of celebrity entrepreneurs, but you also have a lot of entrepreneurs who fail at their startups, even though they work very hard for 4 or 5 years. And it's not because you go to Silicon Valley that you're going to be able to raise funding. Yes, there is much more capital available, but the competition for that capital is also much more intense. So there's a... You know, some things that are being said about this comparison between Silicon Valley and Europe or whatever just seem very silly to me. But at the same time, Silicon Valley is going to continue to be the center of tech for a lot of reasons, and a lot of good reasons.
Yeah, and if we look at the European perspective, how do we stack up against Silicon Valley, or let's say that the rest of the world? Like, are we going in a good direction, you think, in the latest 2 quarters? Because you have a lot of those data. I have been listening to the tech.eu podcast. By the way, if you have not listened to the new tech.eu podcast, go on iTunes and listen to it. Great show with lots of very good information. And Roxanne and the other one was Steven?
Neil Murray.
Neil, they do great job. It's very listenable. And so what I've learned from that is, like, in Q1 and Q2, there are very interesting results. And how do we as Europe stack up on that?
It's a good question. First of all, thank you for the compliment. I really like our show too. So if you look at the numbers, which is always the better way of looking at comparing facts and figures, if you look at the numbers, you see growth pretty much everywhere. There's growth in M&A transactions. The size of it is getting bigger. The size of the transactions are getting bigger, but also the number of transactions. It's getting more diverse. So you see M&A transactions happening in more countries and regions than before. If you look at funding, there's a big increase. So we calculated about $3.5 billion in venture capital in the second quarter of this year alone, going to European tech companies. And there are VCs. The VCs are also raising more money. So for example, the Dow Jones Venture Source says the European VC firms raised about 2 billion euros in Q2 2015. So there's an increase in funding going to funds and an increase of funding going to tech companies. There's an increase in M&A transactions. There's an increase in big companies, you know, scale-ups or unicorns or whatever you want to call it, coming out of Europe. So the numbers are really, really looking very good. They're on the up, they're on the increase. How do they stack up against places like China and Silicon Valley? Very, very poorly. still, so that's the other side of the coin, is that if you have to realize that we are still a very, very long... still a very, very big gap.
You have to have the perspective, of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a big gap between, you know, the funding and the M&A stuff coming out of the Valley and places like China even, that we just cannot compete with when it comes to numbers. And this is something that you also have to take into account, and you have to realize, and you have to be very honest about. Like, you know, there's still a really, really big gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the home. So what do you think about the Belgian entrepreneurship in contrast to the rest of the Europe?
Yeah, so obviously because I live here, I tend to know most of the startups and the entrepreneurs coming out of the, or at least I used to know most of them, because it was very easy to keep track of, because there were only like a handful of investors and there were only a handful of entrepreneurs building sizable companies, right? Now, 2015, I really think the situation is changing for the better. There's companies that are raising funding that I've never heard of. There are new investment firms being born, mostly by ex-entrepreneurs banding together their resources and starting proper VC funds, which we've always had a lack of. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the government has been a little bit more active in supporting entrepreneurship and implementing policies to help entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. There's this organization called Startups.be that is doing a massive good job. There's co-working spaces popping up, accelerators in Antwerp and Brussels, etc. So I think overall the evolution is kind of what you see in the rest of Europe as well. There is some maturing going on, but it's going to take obviously a long time, and there's going to be stumbles and challenges and barriers along the way. But I think in general I'm very, very positive and optimistic about the Belgian startup scene actually.
Yeah, when we look at the other ones that are growing, again, I'm leaving like Berlin and London aside, not even Paris. So I'm seeing that the rest, like Paris, Stockholm, Amsterdam, they are doing quite bold moves, right? They are dedicating their top policymakers. They are creating new rules, and they do great on advertising. They are like, they try to make big steps and they see the results now. Why do you think that in Belgium we are not getting there?
So yeah, so first of all, I would say that not everything that, for example, France or the Netherlands does is necessarily good for the ecosystem. It's not because you give it a lot of attention.
But and you have to try, right?
You have to try. So at least something's happening. And I have to say, with the last federal government that actually I've been advising for a minor part, and also with the Belgian Startup Manifesto, you finally start to see the change. And I think it's also a question of people. You have to have people in the cabinets and the relevant government departments that really care and know about entrepreneurship. So it's also, it goes both ways. It's up to the startups and the investors and the early stage tech people to actually make some noise about it as well. It doesn't necessarily help to complain and to bitch about it, but not try to change anything. So you have to talk to the policymakers and you have to make them aware of your challenges and your problems so they can do something about it. And if you don't speak up...
Don't take complaining away from us, man. That's
well, you can still complain, but you have to complain to the right people, not complain to your fellow entrepreneur. You have to complain to your policymaker and tell them what your problem is so they can do something to fix it. And if they don't, then you can complain about it.
Yeah, and that will be like the positive complaining, really, rather than trying to just say that, okay, nothing is happening and I'm doing nothing. So I'm contributing to do nothing, basically, and nothing happens.
Exactly. There's too much of that going on everywhere in the world, not just in Belgium.
But. Yeah, indeed. So now that I'm also in Turkey, currently. I'm also a little bit connected to the startup scene, and there has been some recent news in Turkey. What do you think about the emerging tech hubs like Turkey, Hungary, Poland, Bulgaria?
Well, as I said before, I think it's all very exciting. If you look at Turkey in specifically, I spent some time there quite recently, actually. But I'm always amazed at is how big a company that you can actually build in Turkey without focusing on any other country. So you can build $1 billion e-commerce companies like Marcafoni, just operating in Turkey, which I think is phenomenal. There's a huge base of people. There's a lots of internet adoption. A lot of these people have credit cards and do online shopping. I know that Turkey is very big on social media as well. I think they're the biggest YouTube viewers per capita in the world. So very active.
Also Facebook.
And also in Facebook. So they're very active online, both in shopping and using the internet. So that opens up a lot of opportunities for local entrepreneurs. What I do think is that Turkish startups tend to have a lot of difficulties expanding outside of their country, which I think is a huge challenge because you have the Middle East on one side and you have Europe on the other side. So that should be a recipe for large companies or large pan-European companies. But so far, we haven't really seen that.
Yeah, you would think that it would be an advantage rather than a disadvantage, right?
Of course. Being on the crossroads of those two massive regions that are growing economically, that should give you actually a very big advantage. But so far, we really haven't seen it. It's also very hard for other companies to break into Turkey. I think of Yandex, for example, mm-hmm. who's very successful in Russia competing against Google, but isn't necessarily able to challenge Google in Turkey so far. So
yeah.
So I keep asking myself the question, why is that?
Yeah, indeed. Turkey has a lot of specificities on its own. You have to really know the consumer and you cannot really do the things remotely and just try to copy your business model and hope that it works.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work that way. But Yandex actually has been amongst the even most successful ones. Like they have 15% of the market share, which in any other country, I don't know any other country actually who has less than 90% of the search engine share for Google.
I'd be very surprised if Yandex has 15% market share in Turkey. I think the last figure they shared was about 1.5 or 1.6, but I might be wrong.
Because of the maps, the Yandex maps are quite accurate and useful. So as far as I remember, the numbers were like that. But we can check again. But at one point, they were very well adopted. And I was also seeing it around me that a lot of people were using Yandex. But again, it's a problem of getting into the specificalities of a country, I would say.
Yeah, of course, and that goes for any company. But I'm very hopeful. If you look at companies like BlaBlaCar, for example, you know, the French ride-sharing enabler that has been, you know, they raise $100 million round. They're expanding very fast. They merge with carpooling. And this is a company that doesn't focus on the US or China at all. Right. So far they've grown in Europe and Latin America, etc. And they're also going to India. But they've left behind the fact that you have to go to the US or you have to be in China to become a really big company. That's no longer true. If you look at Zalando, they sell in 15 countries or 16, and all of these 16 countries are in Europe.
Yeah.
But they have a 6 billion euro market cap. They're a listed company on the stock exchange. So that's a massive internet company that comes out of Europe focusing only on Europe. Which I think is very, very encouraging to watch.
Yeah, indeed. And and it's very exciting for us Europeans as well. Like, it's a new horizon for us. Like, we don't have to necessarily expand into US to become a unicorn.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So, I would like to end the interview on a personal note. So, how can the European entrepreneurs reach you? And which are the next events for you?
That's a good question. I'm kind of slowing down on travel. Mm-hmm. So you won't see me at a lot of the big events in the next six months.
They have to come to Belgium.
They have to come to Belgium. I usually work out of CoStation, which is a co-working space in central Brussels, at least mm-hmm. once every 2 weeks, at least one day. So I'm very happy to take meetings there. I'm very easy to reach on Twitter. My email is robin@tech.eu. So whenever you have a question, just ping me on Twitter or send me an email or try to meet me in person. I'm very open to conversations with anyone. Very easy to approach.
Yeah, and I know that I can attest to that personally.
There you go.
So, Robin, I know you are very busy, but thank you very much for making time for the inspired European entrepreneurs who would like to create a breakthrough and open up Europe. And hope to see you soon.
Thank you very much for the interview. I really enjoyed it. And best of luck with the podcast.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the fourth episode of Open Up Europe podcast, where my guest was Robin Wouters. And wow, such an inspiring interview was it. I personally loved the part how him being let go from a major media outlet led to a successful page in his career. On the website, there will be more posts about this interview and you can find great resources. So don't forget to send your comments either on the blog post or at ok@openupeurope.com or on Twitter with @openupeurope. Peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Open Up Europe podcast. For the resources mentioned in this episode and the transcript, go to our website on www.openupeurope.com. And don't forget to sign up for email lists. We are also on Twitter and Facebook with the same handle, Open Up Europe.